This is the Marketplace Morning Report. I'm David Brancaccio.
There's news this week that evictions, tenants told to move out by landlords, dropped a dramatic 18% in New York City over the last year. This after the city allocated more money for legal services to help tenants challenge these evictions. Still, there were nearly 22,000 evictions in New York City in 2015. And nationwide, it's argued that evictions have become a disturbing routine feature of life at the margins. Matthew Desmond is a sociologist and co-director of the Justice and Poverty Project at Harvard. He spent the last 8 years researching evictions, focused on Milwaukee. His new book is called Evicted: Poverty and Profit in the American City. Professor Desmond, thank you for joining us.
It's great to be here.
So evictions, I think your research shows, used to be relatively rare. Now you see them as more ordinary. Now, you're talking here not necessarily foreclosure, but tenants in rentals being removed for whatever reason?
That's right. So foreclosures are when someone who owns their own home has that removed from them by the bank or lending institution. Evictions are what happens to renters. And most evictions happen to very low-income families who are living in the private rental market.
I see. Now, you zoomed in. You've spent your years studying in a particular region, Wisconsin, right?
That's right, Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
And tell me about the sense. I was looking at the book. Tell me about your sense that eviction is a cause, not a condition of poverty. Tell me what that means.
That's right. So when I went into this study, I thought that eviction would be a good way to understand housing and poverty. I had no idea how big of a role eviction was playing in the lives of low-income families. So eviction causes loss, for example. You lose not only your homes, but your possessions, your neighborhoods. Your kids often have to switch schools. There's really good evidence that eviction actually causes job loss because it's such a consuming, stressful event. Causes workers to make mistakes on the job and sometimes get fired. People relocate to worse neighborhoods, to worse housing, because eviction comes with a record. And so a lot of landlords won't take them. And then there's the toll eviction has on someone's spirit, their mental health. Mothers who were evicted are depressed 2 years later after the event. And when you add all that up, it's really hard not to conclude that eviction is a cause, not just a condition of poverty, and that we can't fix poverty in this country without fixing housing.
But it's your sense, or in fact your data show, that it's becoming commonplace as opposed to the exception?
When you read books from the 1930s, 1940s, these eviction scenes, they're scandalous. You know, they're weird. You know, people have come out of their homes to protest. Sometimes they confront the marshals directly. They're scenes of outrage, and you get a sense that they were very rare. But today, evictions have become somewhat of an epidemic. They're coursing through the American city. They become very common in low-income neighborhoods. And the reason for that is because we've reached a point in America where most poor renting families are spending at least half of their income on housing, and about one in four is spending over 70% of their income just on rent and utilities. And under those conditions, eviction is something that's become very frequent in the lives of poor families today.
Well, I'm imagining the household budget that you just suggested. So a major piece of the pie, the predominant section, the major section is going to be the cost of housing. So if something goes wrong, requiring a new transmission in the car or a medical expense, then suddenly you get closer to eviction.
That's right. And I think that most Americans still think that low-income families either live in public housing or benefit in some way from housing assistance. But the opposite is true. Only about one in four families that qualify for housing assistance receive anything. And in some of our largest cities, the waiting list for public housing isn't counted in years, but in decades, which means that, you know, a young parent, for example, that put his name on the waiting list could literally be a grandparent by the time their application is renewed. And so most poor families are struggling without assistance in the private market, giving most of what they have just to keep a roof over their head. And under those circumstances, a small deviation, you know, a work reduction in hours, a sanction of public benefits, a family emergency can tip a family into eviction.
Now, it costs money for a landlord to have to find a new tenant to spruce up the apartment one more time. Are landlords working hard enough to keep the tenants from actually getting evicted?
I think that landlords have a lot of discretion over the evicted decision. You know, they can decide to work with this tenant and not work with the other one. And one of the big things I try to do in my research is to understand why. What explains why you get evicted, but I don't. And one thing that we learned is that kids, far from shielding families from eviction, actually provoke and increase families' risk of eviction. So in Milwaukee, having a kid triples the odds that you will receive an eviction judgment if you show up to housing court. And what you're seeing there is landlord discretion. Landlords choosing to work with smaller families or tenants without kids over bigger families or tenants with kids. And it's because kids are really tough on the landlord's bottom line. So there are things that I think landlords can do more. And there are oversights or protections that I think that we need to put in place to make sure the discrimination doesn't color the eviction decision.
I want to talk to you about those in just a second. But just understand this. It's not that having children in a family is creating greater risk of a financial problem. The kid gets sick. It's that when you control for that, just having kids increases your likelihood that you might get evicted?
That's exactly right. So we controlled for family income, and we controlled for things like gender and race. And also, very importantly, we controlled for how much tenants owed the landlord. And even after you control for all that, what separates the near evicted from the evicted is the question of, do kids live with you? And most families that are evicted in Milwaukee do have kids in the household. And really, the face of the eviction epidemic across America is moms with kids.
Let's, in fact, zoom into an individual. I know that Black women are hit especially hard by this problem, this challenge of eviction. You found this in your data. But you profile an actual person. I think it's you've come up with a different name to protect her identity. Arlene is a single mother?
So Arlene is a single mom when I met her. She was trying to raise two boys in inner city Milwaukee. And she was giving 88% of her income to live in a pretty shabby, rundown apartment. And, you know, she was put in these situations where she had to decide, do I pay the rent or do I buy my boys school supplies or school clothes? Do I pay the rent or do I pitch in for my sister's funeral costs, for example? And she was confronting these really horrible, very difficult situations. And I think my time with Arlene, more than anything else, really helped me understand the pivotal role housing is playing in creating poverty and instability in low-income communities. So, you know, in the book, we watch Arlene get evicted because one of her boys hits a car with a snowball. And the driver, you know, stops the car and angry kicks in her door. And the landlord evicts her for damaging property. In another scene, we see Arlene get evicted because she called the 911 for an asthma attack for one of her younger kids. And that, coupled with police coming to visit because her her oldest son had kind of acted out in school, caused the landlord to evict her. So in these situations, you know, it's Arlene's poverty and her vulnerability in housing that's really the reason for her evictions. And those evictions, in turn, drive her to homelessness. They cause her to grow depressed. Her and her boys move into very dangerous neighborhoods after them. And I think that what you see in Arlene's story is the desperation that are facing a lot of moms in poor communities today.
Just so I understand this, the asthma attack meant an ambulance came, and that was seen as somehow perhaps disruptive?
That's right. So the landlord was concerned that the police would come with the ambulance. And when police come to buildings, they can document code violations, property violations. They can activate something called a nuisance ordinance, which is when a property has too many 911 calls. And that could come with fines for the landlord. So the landlord in this case was concerned that the asthma call would bring police and kind of cause him to lose money.
And the landlord in this case is not just a faceless landlord in the book. We get to know the landlord as well.
That's right. In fact, I met Arlene through her landlord, Sharina, who was my landlord as well. I rented, stayed in a room in a rooming house in a predominantly African-American inner city neighborhood and rented from Sharina and followed Sharina throughout her daily life, saw her buy properties, sell properties, work with some tenants, evict other tenants, and really try to understand this issue from her perspective and the perspective of other landlords.
She used to be a school teacher?
She did. She was a school teacher in Milwaukee Public Schools for several years. When I met her, she owned 36 units, all of them within low-income, predominantly African-American neighborhoods.
Through her, you understood the logic from the landlord's point of view of you don't want people showing up with lights and perhaps sirens. You want to have tenants where that is minimized.
Yes. So one thing that I learned by spending time with Sharina is just what she cares about and what would cause her to evict a tenant over working with one. And one thing was if a tenant reported her property to the city for housing violations. Now, you can't legally evict a tenant for doing that. You know, they call it a retaliatory eviction and it's forbidden. But you can evict a tenant anytime for being behind in rent. And if you're someone like Arlene, who's giving 80%, over 80% of her income to rent, you usually start off behind because you can't pay first month's and last month's rent and a security deposit. So there were several cases that I saw Sharina kind of flip from working with a tenant to evicting them because that tenant had reported her to the city. And that means protections that we've designed to help our most vulnerable families stay in decent housing and protect them from housing problems, which we know can really harm children's health. Those protections kind of go away for tenants that are far below the poverty line.
And for people who see this as trying to think about and perhaps even protect some of society's most vulnerable, you think they might be missing something, that this problem of evictions actually affects the wider society, the wider economy?
You know, we know from the latest national data that about 1 in 5 of all renters in the United States pay at least 50% of their income to housing. So the issue of housing unaffordability and the tenuousness of people's grasp on their homes and their neighborhoods is something that's affecting a lot of communities. And we bear the cost of that. You know, we bear the cost when eviction leads mothers to grow depressed. And we bear the cost of instability in communities that are kind of tossed up because so many people on one block or the next are being evicted from year to year. And there's also moral costs we bear when we ask mothers like Arlene to choose between paying for rent or feeding her kids. And we know that when families receive housing vouchers after years on the waiting list, one of the first things they do is go buy more food. You know, their kids become stronger and less anemic. But the vast majority of low-income families aren't so lucky. And their kids, like Arlene's kids, don't get enough to eat because the rent eats first. And I think there's a cost we bear for that, not only financially, but in a very, very normative way.
What policies start to address this more effectively?
I think the good news is we've made a lot of progress. And when you look back over the last several generations, we've made huge gains as a society in terms of housing quality. You know, we don't have that many low-income families living without heat, without running water, without indoor plumbing. Just a few generations ago, we did face those conditions. And so I think it's important when we think about the problem to recognize the progress we've made. I think it's also important to recognize that there are organizations all around the country working really hard to prevent eviction, decrease family homelessness, and preserve affordable housing. And so I've started this organization called Just Shelter, which kind of highlights the work of those organizations. So if you're a reader in Omaha, Nebraska, or Boise, Idaho, you could go to that website and see who's working hard in your communities on these very issues. I think when we ask, what should we do about this problem, we need to ask another question first, which is, do we believe that access to decent, affordable housing should be a right of all Americans? And I think we should answer yes to that question, because without a home, everything else falls apart. Without a home, you're not able to take advantage of the freedoms and opportunities that this country affords. And so if we think it is a right, if we believe that, then I think that we're well positioned to deliver on that obligation. And one way we could do that is by taking the housing voucher program that we already have and expanding it, making it a universal program so that all families below a certain poverty level can receive that benefit. So instead of paying 60, 70, 80% of their income on rent, they pay 30%. And they could take that voucher and they could live anywhere they want as long as the housing isn't too expensive or too shabby. I think we could do that. And I think it would make a massive difference in the face of poverty in America today.
So expanding access to housing vouchers is essentially increasing the government subsidy for low-income housing.
It is increasing the government subsidy in a way that would benefit so many more families. You know, we only offer any kind of housing assistance to 1 in 4 families that qualify. And just think about that for a minute. You know, think of that if we turned away 3 in 4 families that applied for food stamps, if we turned them away hungry. But that's exactly how we treat stable, affordable housing in this country. And so taking this program that already works, that's already giving families massive relief, and expanding that would make a huge difference. It would cost money, would take a financial commitment on our part, but there's also ways we can make the program a lot more efficient and cost-effective. This is well within our means to do.
Matthew Desmond is a sociologist and co-director of the Justice and Poverty Project at Harvard. The book is called Evicted: Poverty and Profit in the American City. Professor Desmond, thank you.
Thanks for having me.